you will, where all this really intriguing evidence is from orbit. We can see clay minerals, for example, from orbit, and we're driving to one of these regions right now, and clay minerals occur when rock interacts with water over a long period of time. We're going to little spots on the treasure map that we've created from the satellite imagery and trying to reach each of those areas, you know, as long as the rover survives.
Order of magnitude, how old are those deposits that you're digging around?
All the geology that we're looking at probably dates from about 3 billion years ago. And that's right at the end of the period that most scientists think that Mars was at least wet with a lot of liquid water, if not also warm. And so we're right at the end of that period when Mars is transitioning into a colder planet and a dry planet like it is today. So it's pretty exciting not just to see that evidence of the liquid water, but also to maybe see a glimpse of how Mars changed so radically to dry and cold.
So, you know, it's conceivable and maybe something to hope for that the rover is rolling across the burial plots of microbes from 3 billion years ago.
That's right. You know, that's when we think Mars had the best chance for supporting life. And so we're really excited to be in the kind of a geological wonderland that dates from that time period.
And finally, Ashwin, you know, the Curiosity rover is not the only spacecraft we've got out there, or it's one of the few rovers, I guess, now, but it's not the only probe we've sent into the solar system. We have the Cassini mission and the New Horizons mission and, you know, spacecraft that have been out there for decades. How would you say that the Curiosity mission complements the other exploration of the solar system by spacecraft? And how could a discovery on Mount Sharp, such as you've been describing here, change our understanding of the history of where we live?
Yeah, you know, NASA has an overall goal for planetary exploration of understanding whether life exists outside of Earth. And, you know, we don't really know, you know, we have a limited understanding of where the best places for that might have been in the solar system or are today. So, you know, I think it's great that NASA is able to explore the ocean worlds of Jupiter and Saturn's moons, and then also go to a place like Mars, which may not have life today, but may have had abundant water on the surface, very much an Earth-like situation 3 billion years ago.
What's up? It's your girl, Nique Love Rhodes, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves. And today we're going to do something a little different. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon, passed away on February 4th, 2016. But we were privileged to have him on this show as our guest on October 5th, 2010. So in honor and remembrance of Dr. Mitchell, I'm going to re-air that interview today. Here then is our interview from October 10, 2010. And today, it's my distinct honor to welcome to the show a true American hero, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Mitchell is a retired Navy captain, former astronaut, scientist, test pilot, lecturer, and author of, among other things, Psychic Exploration and The Way of the Explorer. And on January 31st, 1971, as a member of NASA's Apollo 14 mission, he was the sixth man to leave his footprints on the surface of the moon. He has been interviewed on countless documentaries, TV, and radio shows, and I am proud to include We Are Not Alone as one of them. And welcome to the show, Dr. Mitchell.
Well, thank you, David. It's good to be with you.
It is my honor indeed. I'm sure you've been asked this question about a million times, but if there are words to describe it. What does it feel like to stand on the surface of the moon and look up at planet Earth?
Well, my response to that is, what more can a explorer want, and we're all explorers, to other than go to a place where humans have never been, to collect data, take pictures, look around, and come back and tell the people what you saw. And that's what explorers do, and so it's a great experience.
Well, it was a great experience for America, I'm telling you, to just to know that, you know, there were 12 astronauts to walk on the moon, correct?
That's correct. Yeah. There's 12 that have walked on the moon. Yeah. Only 9 of us are left at this point, 40 years later.
Yeah.
But, yes, and it's the beginning, and I am working on a book on this subject.
Okay.
It really is the beginning of our space age on Earth, and there's not much question, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later, there's not much question but we have been visited by much older civilizations than ourselves.
Right.
And but here we are, we're about to enter that era of evolution on our planetary system where we can go out and be part of a space community.
Right. Right. And I hope we do it.
I hope so, too. We've begun, and we need to continue.
But isn't it awe-inspiring or surreal to be up there and to look at the moon, look at the Earth?
Certainly, the powerful experience that all of us had, and there's a book been written about it called The Overview Effect, where all of us have had some sort of powerful experience. We don't all explain it the same way, but it's a powerful experience that is our experience of looking back at Earth from space and being really overwhelmed with that view.
Overwhelmed with a view, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there are people who insist that the moon landings were all filmed on some Hollywood back lot, and how would you answer them?
Well, the simplest answer is, you really think the Soviets would let us get away with that? This was a race to the moon between the Soviet Union and ourselves. And no way that could have happened. They'd have blown the whistle immediately.
Right. It would seem that the astronauts themselves would have blown the whistle.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
But if people would think that we were trying to cover it up, well, the Soviets certainly weren't trying to cover it up.
No, no. But why do you think people are in that mindset? I've always thought that maybe, you know, the older people, and they, like my grandmother used to say, man will never reach the moon.
Right.
And I think maybe they've said, you know, they just couldn't wrap their heads around it when it finally
happened.
Well,
that's a large portion of it. I often refer back to a statement by the great scientist Max Planck at the end of the 19th century when he said progress isn't made by convincing skeptics, but funeral by funeral. In other words, the old ideas have to die off before the new ones can prevail.
Right.
And fundamentally, he's correct.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that the scientists, if they can't understand what's going on. Now I'm not talking about the moon landings, but, you know, the UFO phenomenon.
Yeah.
They can't understand it. They can't wrap their heads around it. They can't explain it. They don't have control of it. Then the easiest explanation is just to deny it exists.
Yeah. Well, that's when we really don't want to change our mindset about things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very common phenomenon, and we see it all the time. And you know, well, I'll use a couple of little anecdotes as we go through our program here, illustrating my point of view and what I say on many occasions when I'm particularly speaking to young people on these very subjects. And one of the things I point out is that although the Industrial Revolution, if you read your history books, began in the late 17th and the beginning of the 18th century. It really didn't get going till the end of the 19th century. And that was when some of the great discoveries were made, and Madame Curie and Einstein and Max Planck were born and moving around. But I like to tell the story that my great-grandparents went across from South Georgia to West Texas in the United States at the end of our Civil War in the early 1870s. And electric lights went in covered wagons pulled by horses. Mm-hmm. And railroads weren't complete across the South and the West. Electric lights weren't invented. Automobiles weren't invented. My father was born shortly after the Wright brothers made their first flight, and I went to the moon.
Uh-huh.
So from going to the moon, rather from covered wagons to going to the moon, in just under 100 years, is what our 20th century has been all about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is awfully hard to get your head around when you think of it in those terms. And those of us who read the history books, it didn't really dawn on me. Here I'm almost 80 years old now.
Mm.
And it really didn't compute for me till I became more elderly exactly how fast this time was passing.
Oh, yeah. My mother used to tell me, the older you get, the faster time goes. And I could
absolutely
never understand that. You know, and
when you experience it, you're not sure you understand it then.
Yeah, and I said, Mom, why were you right? You know, that sucks. What can I say?
Yeah.
Yeah, you made international news a couple of years ago after an interview on Kerrang Radio in England.
That was quite a surprise, too.
It was a surprise for the host, too.
we were suddenly... Simple statement I'd made many times. Huh? All of a sudden, we were international almost overnight.
Huh?
I was getting calls from all over the world within the next week.
Right.
Just because of that one interview.
Yeah, he acted like he discovered peanut butter, you know?
Exactly.
But in it, you told the host that UFOs are real, and Roswell was a real event, and it really created a firestorm.
Yeah, it sure certainly did.
Yeah,
and I'm not quite sure why that happened, but it happened that way.
Well, I was just going to say, did the host of that radio show notify mass media? Guess what I just found out.
No, I don't think so because I had made those same statements quite frequently in public domain on radio on interviews like this. It wasn't anything particularly new or revolutionary from my point of view. I told my Roswell story. I grew up there.
Okay.
And told my story of that. I've told it several times. But all of a sudden, within 1 week of that Kerrang radio interview, I was suddenly international with that story.
Yeah. Okay, so for the benefit of our listeners here at WHFR, who have not had the pleasure of hearing your Roswell story, please repeat it. Maybe I can make international news, you know.
Okay. We'll give it a try.
Give it a shot.
Well, the fact is, you see, I grew up in Roswell, New Mexico, in the Pecos Valley, and where the site of the so-called Roswell incident in 1947 took place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to set the scene here a little bit. The Pecos Valley in eastern New Mexico in those days was rather sparsely settled. That whole area of the Pecos River running up and down the eastern side of New Mexico, that whole area didn't have more than 50,000 people in it up for 100 miles or so. And my my family, my grandfather in particular, was a 19th century rancher, entrepreneur, and very good at it, and cattle trader. And he helped introduce the Hereford cattle, white-faced Hereford cattle, into the West to replace the rangy Texas Longhorns as beef cattle. They were far better beef cattle.
Mm.
And anyhow, that was his job, and the family lost everything in the Depression of the 1930s. But grandfather had brought the family back, and by the mid-40s, rather prosperous ranchers and farmers, and had several farm machinery dealerships. And so we lived there in the Roswell area, and the family knew most of the people up and down, the large numbers of the people up and down around the Roswell area. And so when the Roswell incident took place, I was headed off for college. And on one day, in the Roswell Daily Record, there was a story of the crash of an alien spacecraft a few miles to the north and west of Roswell. And the next day, it was replaced by a story that said, no, it was just a weather balloon. And so I was going off to college. I didn't pay much attention to it. Okay, that's the way it is. And then I went off to the moon, of course, quite a few years later. And when I came back, I went to visit friends. My family had already left the area, and my father was already passed away. But I went back to the area to visit friends, and was, I invited to deliver some lectures and talk about going to the moon, which I did. And the some of the local folks who the family knew, as I said, we knew most everybody up and down that area. Some of the local folks tugged my sleeve at my appearances and said, could we talk a little bit? And they told me their story of this, or the story of their family, notably folks like the Undertaker, who provided small coffins to the Air Force Base for the bodies of the dead aliens, and people in the sheriff's office who had helped with traffic control and had done some work for the military in managing that in around the Roswell incident. And they told me, because they had been shushed to never talk about this at all by the military at the time that the Roswell incident took place. And frankly, on the theory, or rather on the fear of considerable sanctions if they talked. And here I was, a local boy that was now kind of famous, been to the moon, and they wanted to tell me their story. So eventually I took that story to the Pentagon and told it, and long story short, in got it confirmed in a rather circuitous way, which we'll talk about another time, but in other words, it was confirmed. And so that's the basis of my knowledge, my early knowledge of the UFO phenomenon, that we had, there was a crashed UFO. And the reason more likely for all of that is because the White Sands Proving Ground was right across the mountains where the first atomic weapons were tested, and also the Roswell Army Air Force Base. Now, it became the Roswell Air Force Base when the Air Force became a separate service, but that was right in Roswell. And so one can conjecture that the alien craft was, as we have had quite a few incidents where alien craft are around our nuclear facilities and around the rocket facilities that are designed to launch weapons. So one can conjecture, although I don't know this for sure, one can conjecture that that was their interest, as was the White Sands Proving Ground and the nuclear weapons that had been tested there, and so on and so forth.
Okay. So, yeah, this has been a theory with ufologists that the grown-ups in the galaxy are a little worried that the kids have got their hands on the guns, right?
Yeah,
on the big guns.
One can put it into that vernacular. Yes.
The adolescents are playing with the guns, you know.
Yeah.
So okay, so these people in Roswell that grew up there, like yourself, but we're older at the time and we're paying more attention to what was going on. I love the way you said, you know, I went off to college, and then a few years later I went off to the moon. I love the way you said that, you know, like, you know, not everyone can say that. At any rate, these people told you that there really was a crash of an alien disc, a craft from elsewhere in, not of this earth, is that right?
Well, that was that was what their opinion was. That's what they thought. That is what the Roswell Daily Record had printed, and that they had believed.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, that's the legacy of Roswell.
Did anyone in Roswell who spoke to you, like the Undertaker, what is his name, Dennis?
Well, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't the Undertaker himself. It was his family. He was gone by that time.
Okay. Did anyone tell you, I was there, I saw it, I saw the debris, I saw the bodies, whatever?
No.
No one saw them. Okay, so then you went to the Pentagon, told your story, asked someone at the Pentagon. Who'd you ask?
Well, I was, I asked to brief, to talk to the Intelligence Committee of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was with some other gentlemen. I was with Dave, I'm blocking on names right now, sorry.
Mm-hmm. But someone in the know.
Yeah, in the know, military guys,
mm-hmm.
and also UFO guys.
Okay.
And we asked for a meeting in the Pentagon with the Joint Chiefs of Staff Intelligence Committee, got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went there and told our respective stories of what we knew about all of this.
Mm-hmm. And what did they say?
Well, I just told a story just like I just told it. That was my story. That's all I knew.
No, but what did they say at the Pentagon?
The officer that we talked to said, I don't know about that, but I'll find out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't get back to me, and I'll get back to you. Well, he didn't get back to me, but presumably he got back to some of the other people with me, Commander Will Miller, I'm starting to get the name,
mm-hmm.
and Stephen Greer.
Okay.
Were there with me. And he got back to Stephen, I think, and saying, well, I didn't know about that, but I know where the black budget money is managed in the Pentagon.
Hmm.
Now, subsequently, one of my other colleagues encountered this gentleman, this admiral, in Las Vegas, where presumably he was looking into these special access programs. And the story is that, like some that the president, like Bill Clinton, had sent out Webster Hubble to start finding about UFO stuff. They got rejected, saying, you don't really have a need to know. And this admiral was not very happy with that answer, that he didn't really have a need to know.
Okay, so it makes you kind of think, you know, you go in and say, is there really a Santa Claus? And they say, they're not going to say, you don't have a need to know. They're going to say, what are you, nuts?
Yeah.
But you go in and you say, are there really UFOs? Well, you don't have a need to know.
Yeah.
And yet they seem to put the UFO and phenomenon in with Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny.
Well, that depends on who you're talking to.
Uh-huh.
It's changed markedly here in the last few years.
Okay.
As the climate has changed and the fact of the ufology has become a more sought-after set of thinking,
mm-hmm.
ideas, and the public has become somewhat convinced that, yes, this stuff is real. And we've had some awfully good books come out. And I know, as I'm sure you do, know most of the serious investigators like Timothy Good and Richard Dolan and
right.
all of these folks who have spent quite a few years digging out the details
right.
of the UFO phenomenon.
Right.
And, of course, with their investigations, they have enlightened the public a great deal with the facts of these and dug it out of the hidden recesses and dug it out of the lore that until now could be dismissed fairly easily, but it really can't anymore because there's been too much of it.
Too much of it, yeah. I need to take a short break here just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM. the only station making waves out of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone.
I'm a doctor.
I'm a teacher.
I live in the South.
California is my home.
I speak fluent Spanish.
No hablo español.
I have brown eyes.
My eyes are blue.
We're very different people, but we do have something in common. I made a donation to the Red Cross.
When disaster struck and I needed help, her gift to the American Red Cross changed my life.
When you support the American Red Cross, you change a life, starting with your own.
Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org and find out about life-changing opportunities in your area.
I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon for you youngsters who don't know about who Mr. Mitchell is. So, Dr. Mitchell, you mentioned Stephen Greer. Mm-hmm. Now, he is the... he runs the... what is this?
Well, he called it CSETI.
Okay.
I can't remember what that acronym stands for, but he is a long-term investigator of the UFO phenomenon. Right.
He also runs the Disclosure Project.
Well, he called it Disclosure Project. There are several Disclosure Projects. Mm-hmm. Stephen Greer is one. Bassett is another one.
Stephen Bassett, yeah.
Stephen Bassett is another one that's doing a lot of work. Hmm. And they're both been working for many years trying to clear the climate here and to get these ideas accepted and looked into by the general public.
Right.
And to get our governments to open up their files. And it's slowly starting to happen. Slowly starting to happen.
England is opening up their files.
England's opening up their files. Mexico, Brazil is making a big deal of opening
Brazil,
up their files.
Brazil, yeah. Brazil is really coming forward.
They're coming forward in big time, acknowledging that there's lots of blocks of highly classified documents that are now being opened up. So the climate is changing in this area.
So what do you think is the reason for the cover-up all those 60-some years?
Well, one can conjecture on this, and it would appear that in the early days, the military was concerned that the people would panic, and they couldn't. The military, particularly the Air Force, was not in a position to control the skies. And here, these guys were controlling the skies, as it were, and they couldn't do anything about it. So it made the military not look so good. So I think most in the early days, it was the idea that the people would panic. And I think this came about from the Orson Welles thing in the late 30s about the Martian invaders, and it did cause quite a stir. And that may be what they were working at. The other thing might have been that they, a fear of loss of control, that they'd look bad.
Right.
So anyhow, we know the story. The story was that the... before the Roswell incident happened in 1947, which was right after World War II, and the military, or rather the intelligence service of the World War II, the OSS, had been essentially dismantled, and the CIA had not been formalized yet. The Army Air Corps had been made into an independent service called the U.S. Air Force. So everybody was kind of new on the job. And President Truman, at that point in time, realizing that there was an event here, organized the Military and Joint Intelligence Committee, called MAGIC, and turned out to be MAGIC 12, to manage this project. And apparently, although I don't personally know all of this, apparently it kind of got out of control over the years. And took control of this whole issue. And I have a sneaky suspicion that it had more to do with control and profit and what's the technology and how do we get control of that technology than it had to do with anything else.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that it started out with fear of panic, because that was Roswell was like 9 short years after War of the Worlds radio broadcast.
Yep.
But and now it has become the technology.
Yep.
And according to Stephen Greer and many, many others, we have that technology. We back-engineered that technology from crashed disks.
Well, that could very well be the case. I don't personally know that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
However, that could very well be the case, and I would not be terribly surprised if it is.
Has Greer offered to show you any of this back-engineered technology or anti-gravity technology?
No.
He has not.
Well, I don't think Greer has any more access to that than I do.
Well, he seems to be touting the fact that they have these, and they're making and not only anti-gravity but zero-point energy devices. You can heat.
Well, one would not be too surprised if that were true. I would not be surprised if that were true.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not know personally that that is true,
mm-hmm.
because zero-point energy and zero gravitational, rather reverse gravitational devices, are, in my opinion, right where the future is and what we need to be looking at.
For sure.
And if indeed our visitors are from advanced civilizations, like they would have to be here,
mm-hmm.
then I would not be surprised if they have that technology. I just don't personally have any independent knowledge of it.
Right. But and yet the oil industry, the energy industries, are the backbone of our economic structure. Is that right?
Yes, I know. Right. And I have observed over the years that, and although I have looked at zero-point energy technologies and people working in it for a large number of years, those oil industry and traditional energy companies are the first to try to suppress and threaten if this stuff is carried out, and to buy it up to get rid of it.
Yeah. So it would be the oil barons, the energy, atomic energy folks that don't want this secret out. Am I right?
Well, one can theorize that. Mm-hmm. You know, I do not know. It is quite clear that there has been a hiding of this information.
Mm-hmm.
And it is very, very difficult to find out who is behind it.
Mm.
And I don't know a sure way to know that.
No.
But there's not much question that it has been covered up, and slowly it's getting uncovered at this point in time.
Right.
And hopefully in due course. And those of us, although I don't work with Stephen Greer, haven't for quite some time, all of us, himself, Bassett and myself, many of the writers in the UFO field have been pushing for a disclosure for a long, long time.
Yes. I know I have.
Yeah, we're all trying to do exactly that.
Yes. You had been misquoted concerning NASA's alleged knowledge of the UFO phenomenon, and NASA put out a statement saying, in part, Dr. Mitchell is a great American, but we do not share his opinions on this issue. What happened there?
Well, I think this came out of, as you pointed out, that Kerrang radio article, and I think if this is a misinterpretation. When I've said in some of these areas that when I referred to government, reporters have thinking I was referring to NASA.
Oh.
And that simply wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
I was referring to government in general, not a particular, and that's how NASA seemed to have taken offense at that. But on the other hand, nothing has happened when I was in NASA that indicated anything that we in NASA knew that others did not know about this.
I see. But
so that was just one of those mistakes of of reporting and press activity.
Oh, yeah.
That we both run into enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you're aware of the rumors that are out there that NASA is aware of UFOs. Do you have
any? They may be, but I don't know. There may be certain segments, just like all. There's a lot of segments of government.
Mm-hmm. Departmentalized, that, right?
Beg your pardon?
Departmentalized.
Yeah. A lot of people that have special access, access to special access programs.
Mm-hmm.
But this is these are isolated individuals who, for one purpose or another, have been granted access. But it is not department-wise or department-wise or agency-wise in the government.
Right, right. And you wouldn't have access to it. But I'm sure you're aware of the rumors. You've seen, rather, not the rumors, but the NASA videos of objects in space making right-hand turns on a dime, and especially the tether.
Those all are in more recent years. Up through the Apollo program, we didn't have any of that.
Okay.
But with the shuttle program, there have been some modern videos and photographic equipment. There have been some things that look suspiciously, look like UFOs. But in the earlier days, in the Gemini and the Mercury programs and the Apollo program, there were a few things, but there wasn't anything that was truly demonstrated to be to fall in the category of alien type of visitation.
Right. Now, you've seen David Sirita's tether incident as evidence of NASA UFOs. Can you see the
I've heard of it, and I'm sorry I kind of go a different way on that.
You do?
Yeah.
What do you think those objects were around the tether?
You're going to have to remind me what you're really talking about.
Okay, the astronauts went out and put this long tether out. It was supposed to absorb energy in space. They're testing this long cable, and it broke away, and it was went a few miles off, you know, maybe 100 miles away from the shuttle.
Which one are you talking? What are you talking about here? I'm sorry, I'm not with you.
Okay. I don't recall the mission.
It had to be a shuttle mission, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not up to speed on all of that.
Okay.
I've talked to everybody up through Skylab.
Okay.
And know personally their experiences, but I have not stayed on top of all the shuttle experiences.
Right.
And I do know that there likely have been some sightings and some photographs.
Right.
In during the shuttle program. That are perhaps indicative of what we're talking about.
Right. And one member, I think it was Carol Rosen, a member of the Disclosure Project, who said that she has it on good authority, and she's seen some of these photos, that NASA is constantly, I'm going to say satellites in outer space that constantly get pictures of UFOs, and they airbrush them out.
Well, that could very well be. I know Carol very well,
yeah.
And I've heard that story too, but I have no hard evidence to support that.
Okay, but you know that she has said that.
Yes, I know she said that.
But you don't know firsthand. You're not going to commit to that.
No, I'm not, because I don't commit to anything I don't have firsthand knowledge of.
Okay. But in conversations with other astronauts, have any of them ever confided UFO accounts to you?
Well, several of the guys, the early guys, from their Air Force experience and military experience prior to being astronauts, the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
They had encounters as fighter pilots. They were vectored in on them.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as being in space, up through the Apollo program, and no, up through the Skylab program, actually.
Hmm.
I've talked to all the people, and I have not encountered any knowledge there or incidents or experiences there that would go in this direction.
Okay. Now, on the first moon landing in July of 69,
yeah, there was...
Right, okay. There was reportedly a transmission between Neil Armstrong on the surface of the moon and Buzz Aldrin, where Armstrong claimed to see huge UFOs on the rim of a crater. What do you know, if anything, about that?
Well, since I was in mission control during all of that, that didn't happen.
That did not happen.
Yeah. That's been a story that's floated around, but to my knowledge, that did not happen.
Okay. Okay. Well, we've gotten rid of one rumor then anyway. I'm going to have to break one more time to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with former astronaut Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And Dr. Mitchell, we've heard all kinds of theories on the alien agenda. What's your take on that?
Well, I would suspect, from what I understand now, from what my research has shown me, they've been coming around for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would suspect that a lot of our early lore stems from the visitation back hundreds of years, perhaps. Obviously, observation is one thing. See how this planet's coming along. Maybe it's a, I don't know, maybe it's a vacation spot for touring aliens to let's go over to this little remote planet out here and look down at the idiots, that primitive society.
The zoo.
Years ago.
The zoo. Huh?
Yeah.
This could be a zoo.
Yeah, that zoo. But, you know, we don't really have any hard knowledge here. At least I don't have any hard knowledge. And we can only conjecture. But it would appear, you know, there's a Michelangelo painting. You may have seen it, too, that has a UFO up in the corner of it.
Oh, yeah. There are a lot of Renaissance art.
Yeah, you know? That had that.
Yeah.
And one can imagine that some of the early lore, even in the Bible, or even in our religious literature, the cosmologies and the lore of chariots in the sky and so on and so forth, stem from alien visitation. Now, can we prove that? No, absolutely not.
Mm.
But, you know, Eric Van Daniken has written books about ancient astronauts.
Right.
And although I wasn't sure of that earlier on, and when I started, became really interested in all of this. But over the years, as I've dug deeper and deeper and deeper, I'm more convinced than ever that they've been coming for quite a long time.
Yeah. When did you first start getting interested in the UFO phenomenon as opposed to just, you know, the astronaut end of it?
Well, it really happened when with the Roswell incident.
Okay.
When I came back from the moon, and my family friends or people that knew me from that area or knew our family from that area tugged at my sleeve when I was making appearances and wanted to tell me their story, primarily because they didn't want to carry that secret to the grave, and they had been shushed up by military and under severe penalty if they talked. And here I was now a famous character in their eyes, and had been to the moon, and a local boy, and they thought I was credible and would safeguard their secret for them because they didn't want to carry it to the grave.
Ah. Have any of them, well, that was back then.
Well, that's been 40 years ago.
I was going to say, yeah. It hasn't been.
They're all gone now.
They're all gone now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the person that I have contact with recent, not all the time, but is Jesse Marcel Jr.,
right.
who is the son of the first military officer on the site of the Roswell crash.
Mm.
And he and I have had communication over the years.
Mm.
And I have had communication with Robert and Ryan Wood, who have got the wonderful site on Magic 12.
Mm, yeah.
I'm sure you've looked at their stuff.
Yeah, Ryan Wood has been on the show. I'd like to get his dad on the show.
Well, I don't know if his dad is doing public work anymore.
Yeah. Really?
I don't know. He could very well be. Yeah, I've talked to Ryan recently, but I haven't talked to Bob Wood in a long, long time.
Hmm. Well, maybe I missed out on that. I'm glad I didn't miss out on having you on the show, I tell you. But there are still several witnesses still alive from the Roswell
crash. I think there probably are. I haven't been in touch with any of them personally in recent years at all.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, I have been to Roswell a couple of times, and there's quite a tourist industry grown up around the alien alien stories in Roswell
right.
at a museum and so on and so forth. I just haven't been back there in quite some time.
That's another thing that the the skeptic likes to say was, oh, they started that story so that they could make this little town a tourist attraction.
Right. Hardly so. Everybody was under severe penalty if they opened their mouth about it.
Now,
for many, many, many years.
Yeah. When you say severe penalty, did anybody ever say exactly what this severe penalty was?
I cannot speak from real first-hand knowledge here,
mm-hmm.
but I have worked with enough military people and intelligence people.
Mm-hmm.
There have been people disappear and death as a result of us talking out of turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot personally document that or personally attest to it, but people of my knowledge who have been involved in this for many years do tell some pretty credible stories.
Yeah. Well, what's this gal's name? This now elderly woman, Roe, is that her name? From Roswell? This girl was like 12 years old and saw the bodies, and...
I vaguely remember that story, but I'm not familiar enough with it to talk to about it.
And even as an elderly woman, when she tells the story of this sergeant who threatened her as a 12-year-old child, saying, you know, it's a big desert out there, and they'll never find your body, she's sincere, and she's visibly shaken.
Well, I can imagine. One of my connections was another Air Force major who was on the base at the same time Jesse Marcel was, and he was a friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And after my Roswell incident, when I came back, I was able to be in touch with him, and he confirmed from his point of view and his knowledge, although he wasn't intimately involved with the investigation, he did know Jesse, he did know the story, and he said from his point of view, it was a real incident.
Okay. And Jesse Marcel Jr., of course, it was his dad, Jesse Marcel, Sr., that brought home the
pieces,
the debris, and was so excited about it. He had to stop at home
to tell his family, right?
Tell his family. And so this Jesse Marcel Jr. was a child at the time and handled this debris.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, as I recall, he was 11 at the time.
11?
Yeah, I was 17. I was going off to college.
Mm-hmm.
I was 17. He was 11, so he was a few years younger. But that would have made kind of an impression, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure. And it didn't appear to be anything like a weather balloon or something.
No. However, the Mogul balloon, it turns out, had mylar in it that maybe looked a little bit like some of this metal you bent, and it popped right back into shape and had some of the properties.
Yeah, but now this mylar, the other balloon that you just mentioned.
Mogul
balloon. Yeah. That has not been a secret for many, many years.
No.
And
well,
why didn't they come out earlier and say that? Why did they have to keep hiding that?
Well, there were several stories to replace the story that was alien visitation.
Mm-hmm.
If any of them had been straight and honest, one would have been quite enough. But the story kept getting changed every few years. It's just sheer cover-up.
Oh, what a tangled web, huh?
Yep.
Yeah. So, do you think there'll ever be full disclosure?
I think so. Yeah, it's got to come out. However, the real problem with full disclosure is if it doesn't come out pretty soon, there won't be anybody left with first-hand knowledge.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what they're hoping for.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and so one can ask the question now, just who really is instrumenting the cover-up?
Mm.
And you really can't find any area in government that is solely responsible for it.
Hmm.
It's the fact it's a hidden I think the word cabal has been used, and I think that's an appropriate word, because you can't put your fingers on what department of government, if it's government at all, or as Eisenhower, President Eisenhower in his retirement said, the military-industrial complex. That's somewhere in there, and it's very, very mushy and murky.
Yeah, I would say it's more corporations than military.
I would, too, at this point, certainly at this point in time. I agree.
You have to admit, in my lifetime anyway, every conflict, every war, it's corporations protecting, American corporations protecting their interests.
That's right.
Using our military and hiding behind protecting, defending liberty.
Yep.
And what they're defending is the dollar.
Proprietary information and profits.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly, if it came out that we could have free energy.
I've seen enough of the machinations that go on with inventors getting awfully close to tapping zero-point energy or free energy and see what they go through and cover up and threats and so forth.
They
and
do.
Attempt to buy them out for a song. Yeah, it's pretty pathetic.
You have seen this personally?
Well, I've had first-hand stories because I've been in the field, that field myself, for a long, long time as an investigator, as being called in to consult with inventors and thinkers and theorists to talk on these. And I have witnessed a lot of this type of activity.
So it's all strong arming, huh?
A lot of it. There's a lot has been. I can't say about now. There has been in the past.
And what is the most important piece of advice concerning the UFO phenomenon that you could give to our listeners?
Well, the fact that they're here. They are here. They have been here. And they seem to be observing. And there seem to be evidence of underwater and underground bases of some sort. There seems to be some like the so-called Phoenix Light incident and a couple of others with very, very large triangular craft making appearances. Now, I, as a military officer and an aviator, I don't know of anything in any of the arsenals of the military arsenals of the world that have come even close to that. So one suspects that those are true alien vehicles. And the little saucers, and the so-called flying saucers things, those, and it appears to me, those are just local vehicles. They're used as scout vehicles, and they operate most likely, and this is conjecture, most likely from motherships that are in and out of here.
Have you ever heard stories of any of these craft appearing to come through a wormhole or vortex?
Well, I don't know what a wormhole would look like. there are stories of them suddenly disappearing and suddenly, suddenly appearing and disappearing.
Right.
Exactly what that is, that's hard to say. But cloaking devices could help make them disappear fairly quickly. Their ability to change directions very quickly and do right-angle turns at high speed, that's kind of strange stuff as far as our physics is concerned.
Right. Well, obviously there are laws of physics that we just don't know about yet.
I would say that's undoubtedly true. And if they're as advanced as they appear to be, perhaps thousands of years ahead of us, then it's not surprising that their physics would be and their technology far more sophisticated. We're just beginning to open up in that area now.
Yeah, well, you've heard the saying, the phrase, the sky opened, or it looked like a book opening, or curtains being. This is what I witnessed back in 1962, and this is what got me going on the UFO phenomenon. Is about 1,000 feet, 500 feet in the air. A clear night sky, out of a pinhole, this billowing smoke started coming out, and a huge craft emerged from it, like the sky was giving birth to this thing.
Well, that's a rather powerful experience.
It was.
I agree.
It was. And I've been searching for the truth ever since.
Well, no, you can tell us what you saw.
Yeah.
And maybe one of these days we'll understand kind of how that happened.
Yeah. And this is why you know, there's a theory that they don't go through space as we go through space with, strapped to a bomb, you know. And
well, it obviously has to be something different.
Yeah.
However, the more we look at it, I'm more convinced that we're really dealing in basically a three-dimensional universe. Now, there's facets of it and properties of it we don't understand.
Right.
But, and this, as we get further into quantum mechanics and start to understand non-locality, and I've just seen some brand new developments in quantum mechanics that aren't in the public, really in the public domain yet, but make me convinced of what I'm saying is correct, that when we understand this property out of quantum mechanics called non-locality, or the seeming movement of information that's faster than the speed of light, that's the future. And I don't think that Einstein was truly correct with his general relativity and his limitation of the speed of light. There seems to be some hope now that that's just an artificial barrier that in due course we learn to break down.
Yeah, I think it's been proven through quantum physics that the speed of light has been broken.
Oh, yes, but at the particle level.
Mm.
Yeah, we haven't done that at the haven't really shown that at the level of macro scale phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
It still pertains to information in the non-locality of quantum resonance and waveforms and simple particle forms.
But give us another 1,000 years, huh?
Give us a few more years to work on it.
Another 100 or so.
Yeah, now, not too many.
Now,
if we last that long, we've got to get there first.
If we don't blow ourselves up first, huh?
That's right, if we don't blow ourselves up with our stupidities.
Going back to the Disclosure Project and Stephen Greer, were you able at any time to see some of the Disclosure Project, the evidence that some of the Disclosure Project members claim to have had?
I have not personally seen that. I have not been with Stephen Greer on some of his forays that purport to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We worked together for a while, but it became, we didn't get along too well.
Oh, I see. John Callahan was the FAA, head of FAA or a member of FAA during the time of this UFO incident over Japan. You were in, you gave a speech at the Washington National Press Club where he was speaking. You recall that? John,
yep.
John Callahan.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the radar printouts and the tapes and everything of this.
I was aware of that. I have not seen them personally, but I was aware of that.
Yep. You haven't seen them personally, no. Okay. Where can our listeners go to check out more of your work?
Well, my own website. I have a couple of them. EdMitchellApollo14.com is my personal website. And one of my my Noetic Foundation, noetic.org, just has a new website that's totally brand new. They're just bringing online now, very sophisticated. And my other research organization, Quantrek, Quantrek, .org, is a rather simple website right now. We're just getting it going. So, but those lead people into my world of activities.
Into your world of activities, right?
Yeah.
Along with your books and...
Along with my books.
Yeah. Yeah, The Way of the Explorer. Can you quickly tell us a little bit about that?
Well, The Way of the Explorer is the most recent book. It's in its fourth edition now, paperback edition. that's really an account, the account of my thinking and my putting noetics together and some of the stories, of the early years after coming back from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I have it available here. It's available from Amazon. And, it's just...
People can check it out at your website.
Yeah, right? People can check it out on my website.
Yeah, okay. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the sixth man to walk on the moon. I got to say that again. The sixth man to walk on the moon, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. I want to thank you very much for joining us. And it's been a truly an honor to have you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being with you. And I hope we've helped a few people understand a little bit more than they did.
Than they did, huh?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks again.
You bet, David. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye. And if you have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. And this show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm at their website. And click on the forum button on the homepage. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. Stay tuned to whfr.fm. The station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Yo, guys and dolls, you're at the mall shop with Daddy G. And we're going back to the 50s and 60s. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop where the jukebox is playing and the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Every time I see you looking my way, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat? In the car or walking down the highway, baby, baby, can't you hear my heartbeat?